U.S. employers are often cast as reluctant players in the healthcare system, slotted into the social and economic fabric almost by historical accident, and eager to shed the costs and the burden onto someone else, anyone else. But under duress or not, some companies and organizations are trying to shed that image by becoming more involved with their employees' health, much smarter about what constitutes quality healthcare, and better able to articulate an agenda for reform that would benefit the country as a whole. What if U.S. employers became part of the innovative solution to what ails us? That's what we're going to be talking about on this edition of WIHI with Dr. Raymond Zastrow and Helen Darling. Welcome, everyone. I'm Madge Kaplan, your host and producer and IHI's Director of Communications. WIHI is our free audio talk show with edge, as in cutting edge, we like to say. And the idea with WIHI is to shine light on promising developments that reformers and improvers anywhere can seize and build upon. We do this through discussion, most of all. That's one of the distinguishing characteristics of this program. And I'm looking at the chat screen here, and people are just getting on board. That's fine. Just float right in here. We do try and start on time, which I know many of you appreciate. So thanks, Jesse. And I want to thank everyone for joining today. And if this is your first WIHI, welcome aboard. We hope you'll find this program useful to you and that you'll come back. All right, so we're going to really dig in a bit today to the brave new world of employers and healthcare. Lots to say here, and we're just going to make a dent in it, but off we go. And I want to get right to my guests who are joining me. These are just brief descriptions of who each is, and I invite you to read more about them on our website. Helen Darling, joining us by phone from Washington, D.C., is president of the National Business Group on Health. That's formerly the Washington Business Group on Health. They're a national nonprofit membership organization devoted exclusively to providing practical solutions to its employer members' most important healthcare problems and representing large employers' perspective on national health policy issues. Helen Darling heads the business group's Institute on Healthcare Costs and Solutions. Welcome, Helen. Are you there? There's your phone.
I am. Thank you very much.
All right.
There's
your...
glad to be here.
Terrific. Glad to have you with us. Dr. Raymond Zastrow is on the line from Sussex, Wisconsin. He tells me that's kind of a bedroom community just outside Milwaukee. He is the president of QuadMed, LLC. QuadMed provides on-site employer-directed primary care and wellness to Quad Graphics, and they're a national printing company based in Wisconsin, and also QuadMed provides these services to several other large employers. QuadMed is an active participant in IHI's Triple AIM initiative. Dr. Zastrow is involved. He's got his hands in a lot of pods, I should say, including his blog. Welcome, Dr. Zastrow.
I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, terrific. So here's how things are going to proceed, as we often do on WIHI. We're going to just, as Jesse said, we're going to spend about 15, 20 minutes max laying some groundwork with each of the guests, and then we're going to open things up to your questions and comments via chat. And I want to also just underscore, because often people on chat get very distracted when somebody mentions a website or a reference or a resource. Please rest assured, we're keeping track of all of that, and we'll get that all posted to the website at the conclusion of the program. We've got these nifty resource documents to help extend the life of our discussions today. All right, let's get right to it. You know, the news just keeps hopping every day, so I'm hoping that every one of you joining today can also sort of help us be on the alert for anything you think will add to our discussion. But Helen and Ray, I'm going to start off with some headlines from each of you. You are both keen observers of what's unfolding with healthcare reform, your stakeholders as well. You represent many stakeholders. There's a Senate bill that's hot off the press. What do you see in general that's unfolding here that you like? And we're going to start with the positive. And Helen Darling, I'm going to start with you.
All right. Thank you. Well, there's a fair amount of good news in what we learned last night. The bill that's being taken to the Senate floor, which should be actually possibly even this weekend, first and foremost, it covers about 31 million of the uninsured in this country. That's a huge number of people, and they need health care coverage, and we think that's really important. The costs, while they're very high, $849 billion, it's under a trillion, which is what everybody's trying to do, is keep it under a trillion. So that's a good sign. There is a requirement that individuals have to have coverage, and that's important for two reasons. One, we believe that everyone should have coverage, and unfortunately, we may have to require it to make that happen. But more important, there are insurance reforms in both the Senate and the House bill that are extremely important, and without a requirement, it's going to be impossible to make those insurance reforms work. There's not an employer mandate in the Senate bill, but there is a penalty if an employer has more than 50 employees and doesn't provide coverage. If anyone gets coverage and a subsidy under the exchange, then the employer pays a penalty for all of its employees on a per-employee basis. So even one getting help means that the employer has to pay a penalty on all employees. We like the Medicaid expansion. One of the ways to cover a lot of very low-income people is through Medicaid, and we think that's a good thing. We like exchanges because this will open up health plan options to people who might otherwise not have access to them for a variety of reasons. So I think those are the big mm-hmm. ones. The Senate bill also has something I think very important, especially to people at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and mm-hmm. all of the people who know IHI,
yeah.
a Comparative Effectiveness Research Institute that will allow us to identify what works in medicine and what doesn't, and make certain that we have coverage for what's effective and what's not. So there are wellness initiatives and value-based purchasing, some physician payment reform opportunities, or more delivery system reform. So in general, there are a lot of good things in the two bills, but especially the Senate bill.
Okay, thank you so much. And we'll kind of do maybe a little bit of the flip side in just a second. All right, Dr. Raymond Zastrow. Ray, everyone has said it's okay to be on a first name basis. There's your photo
yes,
up there
please.
For everyone logged in. So are you as exuberant, I guess, as Helen sounds with what's come out of the Senate and in general what's emerging?
Well, I guess I'd say I'm a little bit more tempered, but
okay, that's know, that's permitted.
there is a lot to like. You know, I agree that we need to move on the individual mandates and really improve the access for all, and we're certainly moving in that direction. And I think only time will tell whether the price tag, whether the juice is worth the squeeze in that regard. There's a lot to like with respect to the expansion of wellness incentives that's been proposed, going from 20 to 30%, and I just really applaud that as well. I'm certainly a fan of the accountable care organization model, and there seems to be support for moving towards that kind of payment reform, and certainly more expansion of pay-for-performance in a very judicial way. We don't want to go overboard as they did in the United Kingdom on their pay-for-performance, certainly, but there's a lot to like about that. The expansion of health information technology that came through previous legislation and seems to be built upon with what's being proposed now is a very good thing. We especially need to drive towards health information exchange. That's critical to get us towards what's referred to as true meaningful use of health information technology. And I certainly like the verbiage around patient-centered primary care. It's critical that we get back to basics with respect to providing a solid base of primary care for the population.
Okay.
And as Helen pointed
yep.
out, comparative effectiveness research and evidence-based medicine, these are great things too. Glad that they're being supported in the bill.
Okay, thank you. You know, I so much want to, I don't know what others think, but just listening to both of you, boy, times have changed in terms of even kind of what the business community is paying attention to. So I really want to get into that. But very quickly, I'll start with you, Ray, just so you can kind of flip the coin for us very quickly so we don't get too bogged down. And then to you, Helen, what would you say is either the single or maybe a couple things that you think are lacking or weak or that you wish or you're still maybe hoping might wind up in the final? Ray?
Well, I'll take the first crack at that.
Yep.
I think the real lack of redefining healthcare relative to my verbiage earlier around patient-centered primary care, the fact that we still are working from a widgetized, unit-based pricing model, this is a huge opportunity to fix the problem with care delivery, and we haven't gone far enough to address that. The public option concerns me a great deal. I think there are other ways to deal with insurance reform than putting out the public option there. And I'm very concerned that if the penalties to employers are too weak, then it won't drive towards the desired result. And I'm also certainly, you know, a fan of true tort reform and malpractice reform, and that really hasn't been addressed meaningfully.
Okay. All right. Helen, well, you kind of check off any of those boxes or have some slightly different emphasis?
Well, actually, I would agree with everything he said, and just to add, as there are not nearly enough ways to control costs, so we're buying people into the most inefficient and costly system, which we want them in the system, but we don't want them at the high price tag. So we need much more, many more ways to control costs. We don't have tort reform. I'm so right about that. That is so important. There's certainly not enough to promote primary care, again, a point that Ray made that is just critical. There's not nearly enough pressure, and we need really, really strong pressure to improve safety in healthcare and quality, and there's just not nearly enough, especially on safety. We also, there's almost nothing in there that shows any understanding of the hugely expensive and complicated administrative burdens that are just sprinkled throughout those bills. I mean, even something like saying to employers, you have to auto-enroll somebody, that is, you have to automatically enroll them, but they can opt out. Well, that can cost companies millions and millions of dollars just to do that fact. And then they just don't seem to understand that we've got to really dramatically change the delivery system. And while they can't do it all in this bill, it's really not health care reform. It's basically health care legislation. It's not even insurance reform nearly as much as they were talking about. But change in the delivery system we're buying into is essential if we're going to reduce the crushing burden of health care costs, as the president said.
Okay. So I hear a lot of, you know, very, very bold and almost kind of provocative things coming out here. Ray, let me turn to you. Is this sort of represent, I don't want to overstate it, but a kind of an employer, particularly perhaps for a large employer, we can't speak for all businesses. We understand if you parse the business community, there are all kinds of issues swirling around here. But sort of thinking from the large employer perspective, are we hearing sort of the employer agenda for healthcare? And it really does seem to, if so, it seems to suggest that people are really talking about fundamental change.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Madge. You know, employers are beginning to wake up to the fact that, you know, what they've been buying units of healthcare delivery and not necessarily a healthy, productive workforce. And many large employers who are waking up to that fact are beginning to recast the dialogue in terms of how can we actually drive towards health? How can we incorporate this the same way we address other aspects in our supply chain? And when they wake up to that fact and realize they've got a long-term stake in the health and productivity of their workforce, then they start looking at other more unique solutions, like, in fact, incorporating healthcare on site, as we've done.
Okay, we're going to talk more about that in just a minute. Helen, I read through all the principles for health reform from the National Business Group on Health, and just listening to you, you know, focus on safety and quality, healthcare, IT, primary care, prevention, comparative effectiveness, universal health coverage, et cetera, Ray was talking about patient-centered primary care, medical home, accountable care. you're in that this space here in a big way. What happened?
Well, I think employers, like everybody else, have really come to understand that we're not really just talking about insurance and coverage. We're really talking about a giant healthcare system that's soon going to be 20%. One-fifth of every dollar spent in the United States is going to be spent on healthcare. And that if we as a country, I mean, just in terms of social policy, You know, we can't spend money on education if we're overspending on health care. We can't spend money on foster care. And, you know, there's dozens of things. So as an economy, as a society, we are not getting enough value for what we're spending. And frankly, we're spending more than we need to spend. So I think employers have come to understand that it isn't just as simple. Maybe they never thought that, but they couldn't just change plan design. They couldn't just say, okay, we'll up a copay or add coinsurance or reduce or increase a deductible or not cover something, because that doesn't solve the fundamental problem, and it puts the employee and the family members in the middle when, in fact, they don't understand in some instances that what they are getting is either unsafe or they don't need it. So the recognition has really come in the last, about the last 10 years, that as Ray said, we want a completely different system, including wonderful programs like his, on-site medical care, access to care, primary care, all these things, and that together we'll have more health, not just more health care, and that we will be spending, you know, proportionately less, the productivity both of the workforce and their family members, and the quality of life will all be higher. And those are the things that employers have really come to understand is what their mission is. They cannot be productive and successful and profitable in a world economy, in a global economy, if they don't have a healthy, productive, and resilient workforce. And they really understand that.
All right. So you're just hearing Helen Darling, who heads the National Business Group on Health. Ray Zastrow is with us from Wisconsin. Helen's in Washington. This is WIHI, and I'm Madge Kaplan. And as you can perhaps tell, we're talking about employer engagement with health reform and employee health. All right, before we break things open for real in the chat, I want to at least establish a couple of things about kind of wellness and what's going on here. There are efforts by some major employers in the U.S. To control health care costs, and a lot of those garner headlines, mostly in terms of what's going on with health care and insurance premiums, employees being asked to shoulder more of that as along with co-pays. But then there's this other nascent thing that is going on, and that has to do with the greater engagement by some companies in employee wellness and disease prevention, with ways for employees at some level to begin to kind of claw back on other things they've been asked to pay for, perhaps by achieving some better health. So that's the interesting dynamic that's underway right now. So, Helen, let me just ask you very quickly, and then we'll have Ray tell us a bit about QuadMed. Is this a sort of front and center on the agenda in the National Business Group on Health? The percentage of employees covered by these kinds of programs is still not that high, but do you see this as kind of a wave of the future?
Actually, it is that high.
All
we
right.
see more than two-thirds of all large
right.
employers have a health improvement program of varying degrees,
okay.
but none of them is small.
All right.
And it's definitely, I would say, if we were talking about this next year at this time, it would be close to 100%.
All right. Okay. One of the figures I was looking at, I guess, and it was just a way this was chopped up, it said 28% of employees in the private sector in the U.S. have access to some kind of employer-sponsored wellness program. But your point is well taken. And do you see your organization and other companies sort of looking around? Many of we're very grateful for you for doing some outreach, and many of the people you work with, I think, have joined us today. Are they looking around for sort of some of the best models for these types of programs?
Well, they always are. We do have this year alone 63 award winners of Best Employers for Healthy Lifestyles, and one of the ways that we determine the criteria for these awards is by looking at what the leading employers are doing. And then much like IHI does in safety, putting out there what are the gold standards, in this case the platinum standards. And what we found is that there are, and maybe you want to talk about this a little bit later, but there are four or five kind of criteria that if an employer is doing things in this way, they have a very robust program. And these things are also growing, and they're reaching more and more people. And we're seeing probably the biggest jump is we're seeing more and more employers seeing that they want to have throughout the organization, from the CEO down, a culture of health. No matter what their business, no matter what else they're doing, they also want the organization to have a culture of health.
Okay. I'm seeing a couple little comments on chat are getting in there, and Jim Sparks has asked us about the Safeway model and some of the things that we've been reading about in the press, and we're going to get to that in just a few minutes. Let's do this first. Ray Zastro, we could probably do one, two, three, a week's worth of programs on everything that's going on at QuadMed, both in terms of the on-site clinics as well as the wellness initiative, but I know you've spoken of this all around the country, so sort of give us kind of the highlights of what you're up to.
Oh, sure, Madge. Happy to do so, and thanks for asking. you're right. There is absolutely a lot going on, and, you know, like healthcare itself, there's a lot of moving parts. But what we've done, in essence, is kind of married up primary care with prevention and wellness in one model. So we've insourced the delivery of healthcare, and so we've created these QuadMed on-site clinics, and this actually is about, it's almost 20 years old. And we do this for 5 of our 10 printing plants, and now we've got 5 outside non-quadgraphics clinics as well. And there's varying degrees of maturation depending upon how long you're in it. But at Quadgraphics, where the model is most mature, we have this really empowered model of primary care where we slow down the pace of care and use the time in the clinic, regardless of what the visit is really about, to make sure that we hit all the prevention and wellness milestones, where we look and see if somebody is at risk, if they need some coaching, or even, frankly, get them into disease state management type activities. And now what's, I think, really exciting at Quadgraphics is the way that we've driven the wellness programming into the healthcare plan itself, so that our folks, when they come to open enrollment every year, are given the opportunity to opt into the wellness program, and about 3/4 of them do. And it's an incentivized wellness program. It starts with a health risk appraisal, and then they participate throughout the year by having a age and gender appropriate exam, either in one of the clinics or with a community provider. And then they participate with various wellness activities like exercise, weight loss, and then we work on a few biometrics with them as well around hypertension, if they have that, hyperlipidemia, diabetes. That's we've been at that about 4 years now, and we're beginning to see some definite distinctions between the participants and the non-participants, both with respect to measures of wellness and with respect to how much we're paying for them in the larger sense. And I'll just finish by saying we've started our own nascent disease state management program around diabetes. That's about 2 years young, modeled on the Asheville program. We provide a $0 copay for the actively engaged adherent diabetics, give them a lot of support with a certified diabetic educator who sort of acts as the mother hen for the folks in that program. And I'm pleased to say that after the almost 2 years of being at that, we're definitely seeing some distinction between the participants with respect to their diabetic control as measured by their glycosylated hemoglobins and the non-participants. So we're pretty excited about it.
There are some. Thank you so much, Ray. And I did ask you to sort of pack a wallop of all kinds of things. I do want to tell people, and it will be a link posted as well to the website when we post the audio from today's program, but there's a wonderful case study about QuadMed that is on IHI.org, as well as the Commonwealth Fund's website, as part of a collaboration with IHI. The Commonwealth Fund did do a really nice case study of what's up with QuadMed, all the things that Ray just touched upon, with a lot more details of outcomes, et cetera, and some of the financial savings as well, sort of did the math. So invite people to take a look at that. I guess the question I want to ask you, Helen, and then we're going to kind of open it up, Jesse, we'll remind everybody about chat, is when you hear about what QuadMed is up to, it's really so comprehensive, way beyond sort of mere wellness initiatives, kind of soup to nuts here. Is this kind of thing exceptional? Is it replicable? What do you think?
Well, first of all, they've been at it longer than anybody, so they've been the role model for a long time, and what they've really been ahead, and what Ray is doing there is really at the leading edge. But there are a lot of companies, I think I mentioned about 63 this year, that many of them following what QuadMed did because of, you know, they could see it or they heard about it. They've been featured also in some of our programs. And so we see much more of that kind of more comprehensive model now. And in some instances, we've seen, for instance, really large corporations, they might have a comprehensive strategy that's for the whole, literally the whole world, just outside the United States too. But they may have some programs inside that look like RAISE that has the primary care and on-site medical centers, but not all employees have access to those because it would be mainly in locations where there's a critical mass.
Mm-hmm.
But the model is one that they've really led on and been just a great beacon for many others. But we do have more and more now, and it's exciting.
Okay. All right. Let's do this. Thank you. Thank you both. I think we at least established groundwork. I think it's fascinating in a way that QuadMed, the on-site clinics, actually began in 1990, or the sort of the origins of it, and kept on going. And while everyone declared health reform sort of dead and passé for a while, you know, revolutions were being born in other parts of our industry. So fascinating. Maybe people can pick up on that. Jesse, why don't you remind people about chat? A couple people are already up here, and they're already sort of flagging some of the issues I have in mind. So go ahead. Yeah.
Definitely, Madge. So to chat in your comments, you can use the box on the bottom right-hand corner of the screen there. Just click in the text entry box and type away. Make sure that you send that message to all participants so that everyone's able to see your question or comment. And I was interested in something Dr. Zastrow said, or Ray said before.
Yeah.
How are you subsidizing that $0 copay for the diabetes patients? And, you know, what's the population like for this? How many patients does this apply to?
All right. Okay. There's Jesse.
Well, sure, that's a great question.
That's why we have him on our team, you see. You know,
yeah.
He goes right for it.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, the first year we did this, we identified just south of 600 diabetics, and we made a very comprehensive mailing to them, and I think, frankly, overwhelmed them. Only about a third of the folks took us up on it. One of the laws of unintended consequences, too, by the way, is we found that a lot of folks had set money aside in their flexible spending accounts already, so they weren't quite as interested in that $0 copay. But it's with persistence, it's picked up quite a bit, and now we've got about half of our diabetics enrolled. And frankly, I think the half that isn't enrolled probably has some issues with depression or other comorbidities where they're finding it hard to do that. So we're trying to make individual outreach and actually. Mental health parity is a great time for it because, you know, we're trying to link, you know, mm-hmm. mental health with the physical health here as well. In terms of subsidizing it, it's I think an easy financial model when you start doing the math, because diabetes isn't merely about long-term complications. There are significant and expensive short-term complications with diabetes when it's out of control, you know, vis-a-vis people having to go to the hospital for diabetic ketoacidosis, et cetera. So that's why I think everybody turns their attention to diabetes first for chronic disease management.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll talk a little bit more about perhaps some of the dollars and cents thing. We invite your comments on chat. Pretty much right away, somebody asked a little bit about the Safeway model. Safeway played some role in an amendment in the Senate, I believe, that is sort of trying to essentially expand what's possible in terms of how much of a percentage one could get off one's healthcare premium as an employee by participation in a wellness program. Some of this has sort of proven to be a little bit sort of lightning rod-ish because there are questions about incentives and fears that some of this can become punitive and isolate and at some level perhaps discriminate against individuals because of their poor health. So let's just jump right into it. Helen, you're no stranger to controversy. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, there's no reason to be concerned. But first of all, the amendment, it is in the Senate, and all it would do is allow employers right now under current law, they can provide as much as up to 20% of the cost of the health plan in an incentive to encourage people to either have, for instance, the sort of right behavior, like not smoking, or maybe even be at a healthy weight, or, and this is either one is perfectly appropriate, if they do still smoke, or if they're not at a healthy weight, or they're not at, you know, working out, if they enroll in a program or agree and actually participate in programs, even if they can't achieve the health outcomes that are desirable, they can still get the benefit. That is current federal law. So part of the controversy is people who don't understand that. Right now, even if this change up to 30%, which is what the amendment would allow, or the provision would allow, there's still the federal law that says you have to give people an alternative. And that's required already, and that's not going to change.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you allow an alternative, which anyone can do based on their health conditions, then it is possible to do that. And frankly, we don't think that's unreasonable. Right now, everybody is already overpaying for the health and disability consequences of the people who are not taking the steps that they should be taking to be healthier.
So looked at from, thanks, Helen. That's Helen Darling, and Ray Zastro is with us as well. I'm Madge Kaplan, your WIHI host. We're talking about kind of this brave new world of employers and employee health as part of a vision for reform. Well, Ray, talk a little bit about QuadMed in sort of the real life example. You must have these conversations about sort of how to nuance these things in terms of sort of breaks and trying to lead with carrots and sticks and incentives and support. And if we, you know, QuadMed is a part of IHI's Triple Aim initiative, and so thinking very system-like, we don't necessarily want to blame individuals for their problems. We're trying to sort of figure out what are the systemic things that can be changed.
Sure, and just kind of tagging off on what Helen said, you know, I think our philosophy is that there should be some user's fees, if you will, and if you're a smoker, then it's very likely you're going to be a greater user of the healthcare dollar. And so we see our tobacco attestation process, you know, our folks will attest that they are tobacco free and they get $8 off of their weekly premium. And, you know, so we see that that's kind of a user's fee, if you will. There are a variety of these things that are, you know, subtle and kind of in the fine print of the program. But, you know, for example, if you're in a motor vehicle accident and you were not wearing a seatbelt or you were DUI, your deductible for that jumps up to $3,000 for that event. So, you know, we understand that behavior has consequences, and what we're trying to do is be educational and drive people towards right health behaviors without being overly paternalistic in a negative sense. And that's absolutely a delicate, delicate proposition. It's a fine line you walk when you do that.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, part of what it means, I guess, to kind of get in there and start swimming in this whole area. We have a comment or question, I guess, from Naveen Rao. I apologize if I didn't quite get that right. What is the role of insurers in working with employers to address their concerns? Any kind of new benefits or collaborations that are emerging? QuadMed, Ray, in terms of the model you're describing, do you deal with some insurers perhaps as well in the model?
Well, we deal with insurers for clients we have other than Quad Graphics. But for Quad Graphics,
okay,
we're not only fully, you know, we're self-funded and self-administered. We do our own TPA function. But for the companies Miller Coors, Briggs & Stratton, and Northwestern Mutual, we work with their insurers, and we try to work hand in glove with the disease management or coaching, whatever they have, we'll work right alongside with them.
Okay. You know,
with
Helen, go ahead. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, most, virtually all large employers do have administrative services only arrangements with health plans and organizations like QuadMed. So what they usually do is they have their own ideas in some instances, but in many instances they look to the health plans and the places like QuadMed to advise them on what are the best ways to do things. It sounds like we have a fire drill, but it's frequently a mistake, so we'll keep talking.
All right, well, do take care.
I will. I'll jump off if they start
screaming. Run for cover.
Okay. Yeah, if they start screaming at me.
Okay.
But they look to the insurance companies to give them advice, but they have their own people that they usually get advice from. For instance, like Ray, they may have a medical director in the company who sits with the benefits committee and helps to determine what's the best set of coverages for their workforce given their location.
Okay, all right. We have, that's different kinds of questions. They're coming in, thank you, Helen, of different sorts. Jack Sullivan is interested in wondering if there's any effort to push back on some effective dates of portions of current legislation, as in the enactment period, so to give employers a chance to respond. Maybe, Helen, I'll ask you that.
Yes, actually, it's interesting. Last night when Senator Reid put in his bill, he actually moved the effective date back a year already. So my guess is that is a good chance that there'll be a number of changes on points like that. So, I mean, the thing to do is to let people know that are working on your behalf on Capitol Hill what specifics you'd like to see, and, we'll do everything we can.
Okay. All right. Another interesting question. Does the National Business Group on Health, and I suppose, Ray, you're on top of these things too, have any idea where the EEOC, Employment Equal Opportunity Commission, is that still what that stands for, where they may go in defining what is voluntary in wellness programs? Will there be any potential conflicts with existing laws, HIPAA, ADA, for example? Is there any concerns about running headlong into any of that? Ray, any thoughts on that?
Well, we're certainly dealing with concerns about the implementation of the GINA, the genetic non-discrimination piece. And there's great concern right now that this is going to, if the proposed regulation is put in place the way it's sounding like it's going to be, that we'll be hamstrung when it comes to obtaining information of family history and other risk factors that are not necessarily under the direct control of the patient because of their behavior. And these are important and legitimate concerns. They need to be, figured out. But what we don't want to do is pull so far into a direction of individual information, privacy, security, confidentiality issues that we don't take advantage of the knowledge of family history and really give people information that can help them to stave off disease.
Okay.
There is some, by the way, there's some new, there's actually some conflict, if you will, if that's the right word.
Mm-hmm.
The better thing is to say difference of opinion inside the administration, and they are going to be working with us to try to not just with us, but everybody who's concerned about this, which is a lot of people, as Ray said, to actually affect change. So the worst has not yet happened, and I think we have a good chance of turning this one around.
Okay. All right. So, Helen, I guess you're still okay there. We do hear that little alarm going on in the background.
Well, it keeps going on and off. I'm trying to put you on mute in between.
Thank you so much. Okay, we're just concerned for your safety. Thank you for hanging in there. Other questions that are coming out. Somebody says we may be attacking the problem from the wrong side of the equation with increases in high. Oh, okay. So we're all right. So this is another area, sort of looking a little bit at the quality of food and nutrition. And this was something I wanted to throw out to both of you, which is we've got sort of the very direct hands-on healthcare delivery model going on at QuadMed Wellness. Helen is talking about that as well amongst many large employers in her organization initiatives. As you look out, looking in the communities that you're in and sort of thinking in this kind of population sort of perspective, where else might you have influence or touch points? We know there's a myriad of factors that are going into problems with people's health, take obesity for one, and in terms of sort of available food. And I believe this is what this person is referring to here, just the quality of the food that is available to us. So I realize we don't all have to, you know, become, you know, food experts on this show as well. But maybe as a general point in terms of broader perspective around other issues, Helen or Ray, really jump in.
Well, let me I may be going out any minute, but just to say, so there is a lot going on now at the federal level.
Yeah.
There's a recognition that this is a problem that cuts across every agency and every part of the nation, and there's a lot of work going on now that you'll begin to see the results of that attacks the problem in all its different dimensions, but I think it's certainly good to keep the pressure on, keep writing the White House, and let them know that you care about these topics. This is the time to do it.
Okay. Integrated. All right. And, Ray, I'm sorry. Jump right in. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madge.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that, you know, from the employer perspective, too, you know, we provide food at work. And, you know, I sat down with our food procurement folks, and, you know, to nobody's great surprise, it's a lot cheaper to provide high fructose corn syrup drinks and french fries. You know how much it costs to add french fries to a meal?
Mm-hmm.
Virtually nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just pennies.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think where we'd like to go and what we're beginning to do is actually begin to stratify the food stuff so that we're trying to subsidize the healthier meals by putting a little bit of an internal syntax, if you will, by raising the prices on some of the less healthy food choices. So we're really trying to drive people that way. But, you know, again, there's, you know, individual choices, and we make those on a daily basis and affecting our health.
Right. Okay. So some combination. We're trying to sort of keep the community in mind as well as the individual. Ray, I thought I would ask you, you must be, you know, in private chats with other business leaders. Some people must be in awe of what QuadMed is up to here in terms of, you know, what Quad Graphics really has done with healthcare. What's the strongest business case you would make for doing this? Years ago, when I covered healthcare as a reporter, I can recall some of the people in then the Washington Business Group on Health telling me, boy, at some point they wish they could get out of all of this management of healthcare benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And when I look at what you're up to, you couldn't be more knee-deep in sort of now our healthcare delivery. From a business perspective, how do you explain that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're not just knee-deep. We're up to our neck in it.
Yeah.
But in a very good way. And I think the kind of cutting to the bottom line business case, it's we enjoy a 31% improvement over what the actuaries say we would be spending if we weren't doing it this way. And again, I think it comes back to just a very simple focus on an empowered, energized model of primary care, surrounded by all the things it needs, including, by the way, a high-performance network of specialists and hospitals to refer to. So when we do the analysis with the actuaries, we spend a little bit more on primary care. We know that. It's an investment. We invest in this new model of primary care. We make it up in the reduction in the total spend, and we take that out of pharmaceutical spend. We take that out of hospitalizations, certain emergency room expenses, diagnostic imaging, and other outpatient procedures. So, you know, it's just really turning the prevailing model, which is specialty driven, you know, back on its ear the way things used to be with primary care, you know, as the basis for the healthcare system.
What effect have you had on the kind of local healthcare community and kind of in your area? Would you say you've sort of driven any changes by virtue of what you're up to?
Well, I think we've seen additional on-site that we're not even providing, but other companies have seen what we've done and have followed our lead. And so I think, you know, imitation's the sincerest form of flattery. The Milwaukee's kind of an interesting market. We're very much a hospital delivery system driven market, and we're seeing all kinds of practices. Virtually all the primary care has been bought up by one hospital chain or another, and now the specialties are beginning to be bought up as well. I think that we're having some impact when we have dialogue with some of these chains on the lean transformation of healthcare. We're very passionate about that. We learn the Toyota production systems from our manufacturing parent, so we get to help drive some of that.
Helen, thanks. Ray, Helen, are you still there?
Yes, we're still there. I had it on mute.
No, that's fine. That's okay. What is, probably everybody on this call may know for sure what this is, but I thought I would ask just to be sure. What is value-based design? What are we talking about here? It's a new kind of buzzword.
Well it's it basically is for examples where a decision is made about what is paid for and not paid for, how much is paid, based on an assessment of value. So Ray gave the example of where there's zero copay. If you want someone to be sure to take their medication and you think that the value of their taking that medication far outweighs any cost, so hypertension, cholesterol, that sort of thing, it is a good value to lower the copay or have less copay, so that people will be sure to take the drug. Or in the case of value-based purchasing, it could be steering to more effective, high-performing providers, again, as Ray said. So you might say that there's no deductible if you go in-network to a high-performing hospital, but the deductible is $300 if you go to one that's not high-performing.
Helen, thank you very much, and that does clarify a few things for me. Somebody has asked a question here about, and I'll just sort of embellish on this, about retirees, and I'm curious, the trends that we're talking about amongst large employers, and perhaps this applies to QuadMed as well, is it extending to retirees in many ways, sort of the frame around wellness, for example?
Well, when Harry Quadracci set this up 20 years ago, it was meant to take folks right up to Medicare eligibility. So We take care of pre-Medicare retirees, but the rest of the benefit design as well is set up so that people, you know, enjoy a comfortable sort of retirement. But from the get-go, Harry thought that he'd work in concert with Medicare.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Helen?
Yeah, so actually, the vast majority of employers no longer provide a retiree medical coverage, and of those who do, some number may provide it up to 65, as Ray said. The ones, though, that do provide, which is probably about a quarter of large employers, provide some retiree medical. They are extending some of these particular programs. They obviously are not the ones that usually are tied to the work site for obvious reasons, but they may have programs with incentives. They may have something that offers certainly care management and things like that, and some wellness programs. But they're not going to be as intense as they will offer active employees for lots of reasons, including that retirees tend to be pretty dispersed.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I'm just checking out the chat here. We're getting down to the wire. Well, we've got sort of several minutes here. I want to go back to something that was said earlier on, which was kind of Ray referred to kind of widget-based healthcare and sort of what we're doing in some of the good things we like about healthcare reform, but at the same time continuing in many ways to kind of reinforce the system we've got now, some of the basics of it. Do either of you or does the National Business Group on Health even have a position about whether we should be getting away from fee-for-service towards more bundled payment, sort of pushing in that direction? Helen, start with you.
Yes, and I'll just tie back to something Ray said about that. We definitely feel that We need a totally different payment model to start. And there are lots of things that we know tend to work, like accountable care organizations are very promising. Certainly integrated delivery systems work really well. Primary care works well. There are a lot of things we don't know about what works, especially in dispersed rural areas where there are fairly few providers, exactly how to make create virtual, if you will, virtual delivery systems, based in primary care. But what we want to see is payment reform that, first of all, moves a lot faster than what we're talking about, that also focuses on finding ways that reward providers, especially primary care teams, who are willing to take care of patients and do things that we don't now reimburse for things like coordinated care or longer counseling sessions with patients, group visits, e-visits, things like that. So there's a lot that's needed, and we do have a strong position on all those things. The main thing we want to push for is speed, though, because even with the good things that are in this these bills, whatever bill gets signed by the president, most of them are kind of small pilots. They'll move slowly, and we'd like to put everything on fast forward and so go ahead and implement some of the things. There's a lot we know that works,
right,
but we should be pushing ahead on those.
All right. Ray?
Oh, I think Helen is right on. I think you really nailed it. And I really agree, and I have a lot of passion around this, because I think that, and speaking as a family doctor who practiced in the community, I just know that year over year, as reimbursements for fee for service have dwindled, and physicians have been trying to make up for it in volume. And you know, so now you get the I refer to it as the 7-minute drive-by visit, and you can't do good medicine in this kind of model. Some things in healthcare are kind of inherently unit-based, certain procedures, but when you're talking about primary care, there's just no way to turn that into, you know, widgetized units of healthcare delivery. So I absolutely agree that the model needs to be changed. And as I kind of read the tea leaves on the accountable care organizations, and I will say I'm very bullish on them. I'm cautiously optimistic that this is going to be the kind of the right blending of payment methodologies. We're driving towards shared savings. We have some risk-adjusted fees, plus a little bit. I wouldn't throw out some production orientation entirely, because that helps with accountability and making sure that people show up and go to work. And then I refer to it as just a gentle sprinkling of pay-for-performance over the top to just keep people focused on driving towards the outcomes that we want, both process-oriented outcomes and ultimately clinical outcomes.
Well, well said. Jim Sparks, one of our participants today, says QuadMed appears to be behaving significantly as a patient-centered medical home, and sort of wonders about integration across the entire continuum of care. And that relates to also a comment from David Buchanan, who's wondering about your kind of ability to negotiate with other kinds of specialists and hospitals, as you know, from the foundation of primary care. That information, I should say, is in the case study I referred to earlier. But kind of, I guess, maybe I don't know if that's what you didn't call it the patient-centered medical home. I'm sure when you were setting this up in 1991, but do you, in some sense, feel that's what you've become?
Oh, absolutely.
Yep.
We've embraced that verbiage. You know, I think it confuses some people when they hear the medical home part. And,
mm-hmm.
and I've had some folks one of the Canadian health ministers on the phone and asked me, now tell me about this medical home. Is that like a nursing home?
Mm-hmm.
So that part's a little confusing. So I always put the emphasis on the front part, which is the patient-centeredness,
mm-hmm.
you know, patient-centered primary care. But we fully embrace the principles of the patient-centered medical home. Think that that's what it's all about, the team-based care, but with, you know, a whole person orientation and a physician who's the kind of the quarterback of the team of providers. I'm also very bullish on mid-level providers. I think that with only 2% of our medical school graduates choosing primary care, the primary care workforce is almost by default in the next decade or so going to have to come out of the mid-level professions, nurse practitioners and PAs.
Okay. Well, listen, I get a sense, listening to Ray, don't you, about what you can get when you read his blog, which I've been enjoying quite a bit. We're going to wrap up, but let's do it this way. Helen, I'll start with you, and then Ray, and just some final thoughts. And I'm curious, in some sense, you've got the business community, and we're participating today on today's WIHI, very poised, watching everything that's going on. What's if you had to sort of give a goose to the business community in some sense, or employers, or around these connections, what would it be? Helen?
Well, I think two things. First, I would say we still have ample opportunity to influence how this bill comes out, and we should be sure to do that, because everything we can do to help make it better, it's going to be better for the entire nation. And the second thing is that whatever happens, we're still going to be in the business of trying to ensure the health, productivity, resiliency, and high quality of life of not just our employees and their family members, but the entire nation. and that we have to keep working on doing these things that we're all doing, including what IHI is doing, to make the country better. And we have a lot of reasons to do it. We have the opportunities to do it, and we should do it, not just for us, but for our future.
Thank you. Ray?
Well, I would say to any employers listening, stay connected. Don't turn this over to the government. Remain in the driver's seat, because I think as employers, we are the ones who are in the position to drive innovation and accountability and greater value in healthcare, greater than if this tips over to a socialized medical state. So my exhortation to the employers is don't give up the control of this.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both. That was Dr. Raymond Zastro coming to us from Wisconsin today, and Helen Darling from the National Business Group on Health in D.C., right through a fire alarm of some sort, which we hope was of no consequence. We didn't want her to jeopardize her safety for being part. We opened up a door here today with both of you, and I really appreciate your making the time. And we'll come back. We'll come back in 2010 and talk to you both and maybe some others and find out what's going on. I want to also thank all our participants today. Several hundred of you were on at different portions of the show. We hope you got a lot out of it. If you did, please tell others. You can also find the audio download and a podcast on iTunes, this program, by tomorrow morning. And don't forget, when you sign off today from the computer, you can download the chat, get information there. Look again for our resource document that will be posted to the audio archive as well. And if you have a moment, please fill out a survey that pops up when you log off. Any questions whatsoever, email us at info@ihi.org. Throughout parts of today's show, you heard bits and pieces about the Triple Aim, that is this IHI initiative to discover new designs that simultaneously optimize health, patient care experience, and costs for a population. And we wanted to let you know that this project is about to enter its next phase of prototyping work. Fascinating stuff. That's the kind of stuff you heard about from Quad Med. That will get underway in March 2010, and the Triple Aim group is currently seeking new participants. So you can find information about the Triple Aim on IHI's website. And again, if you want to speak to somebody about that directly, send that email to info@ihi.org. On the next WIHI, and that's on December 2nd, that's a Wednesday, not a Thursday, just before our national forum, 2 to 3 Eastern Time, we're going to go after hospital costs and proven ways to save money by smoothing patient flow. And you shouldn't let the jargon trip you up. Management operations expert Eugene Litvak and CEO Jim Anderson from Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center have a very tangible story they're going to share with you, packed with financial implications for healthcare reform. You don't want to miss that WIHI. And that information is now live on our website as well. So the people who make WIHI possible are Jesse McCall. He was here. Jonathan Small in the studio with us. Mike Sweeney behind the scenes. Alan Olison, Jane Rossner, and Vicki Minden as well. The musical selections that you hear just before WIHI gets underway, performed and arranged by Patricio and Jennifer Batias, and then the music that opens and closes, original arrangements by Aaron Flanders on guitar and Miguel Safasoa on piano. I want to thank everyone who is helping to make WIHI a very, very energizing program. It's my privilege to host a program that's about spirited learning and improving patient care, most of all, for the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. I'm Madge Kaplan. Good day.